ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। Reading from the Srimad Bhagavad Gita, chapter 10, The Opulence of the Absolute, text 19. And we will start with Sanskrit. Repeat after me. Sri Bhagavan Uvacha. Hantate katayesh yami. Divya hyatma vibhutayaha. Pradhanyata kurukshreshta nasyanto vistaras yame. Anyone else? Sri Bhagavan Uvacha. Hantate katayishyami. Divya hyatma vibhutaya vayanta kurukshestra nasyanto vistarasya me. Shall we wait for you? Sri Bhagavan Uvacha. Hantate katayishyami. Divya yatma vibhutaya. Pradhanyata kurukshestra. Nasyanto vistarasya me. Sri Bhagavan Uvacha. Hantate katayishyami. Divya hyatma vibhutaya. Pradhanyata kurukshestra. Nasyanto vistarasya me. Sri Bhagavan Uvacha. Hantate katayashyami. Divya hyatma vibhutaya. Pradhanyata kurukshestra. Nasyanto vistarasya me. Sri Bhagavan Uvacha. Hatate katayishyami. Divya hyatma vibhutaya. Pradhanyata kurukshestra. Nasyanto vistarasya me. Word for word, please repeat. Sri Bhagavan Uvacha. The Supreme Personality of Godhead said, Hanta, yes, te, unto you, katayishyami, I shall speak, divyaha, divine, he, certainly, atma vivutayaha, personal opulences, pradhanyataha, which are principal, Kurushreshta, O best of the Kurus. Naasti, there is not. Antaha, limit. Vistarayasya, to the extent. Me, my. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, Srila A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada Ki. The Supreme Personality of Godhead said, yes, I will tell you, of my splendorous manifestations, but only of those which are prominent, O Arjuna, for my opulence is limitless. Purport. It is not possible to comprehend the greatness of Krishna and his opulences. The senses of the individual soul are limited and do not permit him to understand the totality of Krishna's affairs. Still, the devotees try to understand Krishna, but not on the principle that they will be able to understand Krishna fully at any specific time or in any state of life. Rather, the very topics of Krishna are so relishable that they appear to the devotees as nectar. Thus, the devotees enjoy them. In discussing Krishna's opulences and his diverse energies, the pure devotees take transcendental pleasure. Therefore, they want to hear and discuss them. Krishna knows that living entities do not understand the extent of his opulences. He therefore agrees to state only the principal manifestations of his different energies. The word pradhanyataha, principal, is very important because we can understand only a few of the principal details of the Supreme Lord, for his features are unlimited. It is not possible to understand them all. And vibhuti, as used in this verse, refers to the opulences by which he controls the whole manifestation. In the Amara Kosha dictionary, it is stated that vibhuti indicates an exceptional opulence. The impersonalist or pantheist cannot understand the exceptional opulences of the Supreme Lord, nor the manifestations of his divine energies. Both in the material world and in the spiritual world, his energies are distributed in every variety of manifestation. Now Krishna is describing what can be directly perceived by the common man. Thus, part of his variegated energy is described in this way. Om Gyana Timanandas Yaganandana Shalakya Chakshu Ummali Tangina Tasma Shri Guruve Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobishnam Stapitangi in a Buddhale Slam Rupa Kanamiya Dadatasvapatikam. Okay, please repeat the verse. The Supreme Personality of Godhead said, yes, I will tell you of my splendorous manifestations, but only of those which are prominent, O Arjuna, for my opulence is limitless. So this chapter, and I think chapter 7 also, there are descriptions of the opulences of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is Krishna, the speaker, in this text. And he will go on to speak of various, let's see if I can find one that's actually understandable, of weapons. I am the thunderbolt. And I'm trying to find ones that just aren't kind of context specific to Puranic society, like of the Daitya demons, I am the devotee Prahlad. You need a little background knowledge of who Prahlad is and whatnot. Of beasts, I am the lion. Among birds, I am Garuda, giant Garuda. Of purifiers, I am the wind. Of wielders of weapons, I am Ram. Of fishers, I am the shark. Of the rivers, of the flowing rivers, I am the Ganges. So it goes on and on like this. You think of something, a category, and then he is the best. Krishna is the source of all opulences. It's not that. It's not to say that literally Krishna is a shark and Garuda and this and that and this. The whole creation lives within God, but he himself is the greatest. And even the Greek philosophers, they all, you know, the word God, it really realistically means he who nothing is greater than. He is the greatest. He is supreme. You can't fathom his unlimited glories. And this whole verse is basically talking about that. So this is not just a subject that is in the Bhagavad Gita. It's a philosophical subject that many different traditions deal with, and they deal with it in different ways. I remember talking with some people from Islam, and they actually find personal descriptions of the Supreme to be offensive. And even of their prophet Muhammad, you're not even supposed to describe him with material descriptive words, because that would appear to limit the Supreme and the Prophet, because you're kind of capturing him in a box and saying he is this. Whereas this is saying you have an unlimited God, you have an unlimited person, but we're just going to talk about a limited section of him. And within the limited section, you can see actually when the Supreme is described, the way they describe him is that he is barely contained in these limited descriptions. The description doesn't give the justice, because it's a little bit out of our realm. For a lot of people, this is quite difficult to understand. For me, I like to think of it that we're, not to get too science fiction, but we're all like programmed as we are. Like you program a computer, you program a calculator, and the calculator will do great, amazing sums. It'll calculate, it can even attempt to calculate pi, but we'll never see if it gets to the end of it. It'll calculate almost anything you punch into it. It'll give you an answer. But if you ask it to correct your grammar, it won't work. Why? Because it's been programmed to a limited spectrum. Its spectrum is mathematics. Grammar is not the programming of a calculator. Similarly, we have our physical body, which is limited. You know, you can't, you know, I don't think any of us here can lift up a big slab of rock, or our IQ is measured at a certain point. It's not that we know every single thing in the world, otherwise we wouldn't be in a class. We would be giving classes to the people, the masses. You know, so we're obviously limited. We've been created with limited propensities, at least in the material incarceration that we are now in. But beyond this is a limitless, a dimensionless, and we will never be able to grasp this because we will always look at it in a limited spectrum. And Prabhupada often uses the example of a frog philosopher. There is one frog philosopher and he lives in his well. He's grown up in this well and he's never been able to get out of the well because he's a frog and there's these giant walls. And his friend talks to him from the top of the well, and his friend is trying to tell him about the ocean. And we know the ocean because we've seen the ocean, but this frog has never seen the ocean. He's only seen his well. And so this person is trying to describe to him this very vast body of water. And the frog is thinking of this vast body of water in calculation to his well. So he's asking, how much bigger is it than my well? And, you know, this person's like, what do you mean? No, it's virtually limitless. He's like, no, is it 100 wells or is it this many wells? And he basically cannot figure out anything beyond his well because he hasn't seen it. I think Plato also has this example of the people in the cave. These people, he has this example. If you're strapped in a cave all your life and you see the shadow, you just look at the wall and people do shadow puppets or whatever and you see the shadows in front of you, this is what you'll think the world is. And you won't conceive that there is colours and variety outside. If someone tries to talk to you about what's outside the cave, you won't know. You'll only know the shadows on the wall. So this is basically our position. We're in a material, limited spectrum, and we're trying to understand something that's absolute, infinitesimal, unexplainable. And it's truly beyond us. But, you know, some traditions will give up and well, yeah, like the Islamic people will find it offensive. But in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna is just going to, he's going to just show the most prominent things that we can imagine, all of them, not all of them, he's going to make it concise, as many that will fit and as many that are important. And then it's up to us to contemplate and understand this. Okay, so if you think of any category and you figure out the greatest, then that must be the opulence of God. And not only that, it's not just that's not where his opulence ends, it's beyond that. If you constantly understand that it's beyond that, then you get an idea of what it is. And perhaps you won't try to compete with him, because often that is whatever. Everyone wants to limit God and discredit him, because ultimately we kind of want to be God. And if we can discredit him to a limited person, then we can kind of try to jump on top of him and beat him out of his position. In the purport, Prabhupada is talking about the impersonalists and the pantheists not being able to understand the exceptional opulences of the Supreme. Naturally, it's difficult for any of us to understand the unlimited opulences of the Supreme, but we can at least understand a limited amount of them. And this is our goal. We try to understand that God is a person in our tradition. We try to understand his different life events, his biography. We get involved in that, and we try to know as much as we can. I think Prabhupada, I won't quote Prabhupada, but I just remember hearing that to know someone is to love them. Like, if you want to really love someone, if you know enough about them, then you naturally become attracted to them. So we want to know, we want to love Krishna, so we try to know him. But the impersonalists, they can't understand even the limited things, because their conception is so void of attribute and quality that when you try to explain these attributes and qualities, instantly they reject. Instantly the mind rejects. If you're so used to thinking of the absolute as a featureless concept, as something abstract, it'll be very difficult to give it qualities and give it names. Within your mind, it's upsetting. It doesn't come together, because I mean, especially Shankaracharya, who's a very prominent impersonalist, he will say that, you know, the Supreme is beyond names. So he gives it, you know, there's no name, but there is a name. Even he has to refer to it as Brahman. You know, the names have significance. The name does not limit God. This is the people think, if you give it a name, you limit it. But no, there are unlimited names for God. So you can describe him any different way, but you have to understand that his description does not end there. And no devotee, even beyond the material world, can fathom God absolutely, because he is unlimited. And this concept, we can think about it, you know, in terms of mathematics, you just draw the... But we have an idea of it in terminology, but we have no experience of it. You know, when they try to make machines, there's the famous idea of the perpetual motion machine. You heard of this? It's a machine that will go on forever. Once you start it, it continually works. But there's no machine that does this, because the efficiency is never 100%. Even if it's 99.999%, eventually any machine will break down. It will fail, unless you keep supplying it some kind of energy. And naturally, even this universe, it has to be, according to the Shastras, according to the scriptures, it has to be recreated, because naturally it gets degraded and destroyed. We see it now. Everyone's complaining about looking after the planet. And it's slowly but surely just being destroyed. We can stop the intensity of which it's being destroyed so we can reap the benefits for longer, but we can't stop its ultimate destruction, because regardless of what we do, you see that the culture of everyone is just naturally becoming more and more degraded. We can cultivate what is necessary for our spiritual upliftments to leave this world, but it will naturally degrade. And it's not that it's the end of all hope, because God will naturally recreate the essential things. He will purify it and then sustain it. But it itself, as a material thing, ultimately anything material is temporary. It has to have an end. So unless something spiritual ultimately interacts with the material itself is limited and it will end. So our limited perspective stops us from understanding the absolute, and it stops us from really relishing anything in this world, because ultimately there is an end, and the spiritual has no end. I think I mixed my point up a little bit there. I apologize. Let's see. So anyway, yeah, just sum up a little bit this chapter. For those who are following along, it'll take you through many different categories. Each verse will address one or more, up to four more categories of things, and it will tell you the highest. There is basically, it's giving a hierarchy for the universe, and it is stating that God is above all hierarchy. And these verses are given so you can contemplate anything in this world, any material thing, to give yourself a spiritual conclusion. So if you see birds, you can contemplate, wow, of course, Garuda is the greatest bird, and wow, Krishna says, you know, I am Garuda. So you constantly have some impetus in your material life to contemplate the spiritual absolute truth, and therefore, regardless of whether you're in this material world or transcendent to it, you have a pathway to lead yourself to an absolute conclusion and come out of a material perspective. And of course, no, even if you do come to that, you may not ever come to the limitless end of the Supreme, but there is no loss, because even a small piece of infinity is very valuable. Any questions or comments? Further discussions, Mark? It's possible, but like I said, like, I can describe it theoretically, but because we are only programmed to understand a material realm, it can only be explained theoretically. Like in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, they actually give measurements for the spiritual planets. And I'm not sure if that's actual measurements or if they're just supposed to be, it's supposed to just say it's billions and trillions, it's like, it's really big, and, you know, not to be concerned about it. But, I mean, for example, the spiritual world is eternal, which is something we don't have an experience with, so nothing ever deteriorates. So naturally, you know, your body doesn't get old and grey, and you don't have any need to be sick or all these things. And then also it's explained, at least in our tradition, as eternally variegated. So there is a constant static nature it's constantly the same, yet it's constantly changing as well. It's never quite the same. Every experience is a new experience. Like there's no such thing as boredom in the spiritual world. You can't be bored, really. I don't know. Every aspect of emotion exists there, but boredom is not really there, because the present is so interactive. It's so now. There's so much going on. There's so much smell. There's so much to see with in a spiritual sense, you know, beyond material senses. You have a spiritual smell. You have a spiritual. So I would imagine the best, like this is saying, you imagine what you have, any good experiences you have in this world, imagine, you know, whether it's romantic love, whether it's, you know, having a hot bath, or, you know, basking in the sun, catching a wave, you know, driving a fast car, whatever you can conceive of, and that pleasure that is derived from that, and that pleasure exists in a more enhanced way in the spiritual realm. And any negative feeling you have, like angry, and, you know, some people like to be angry, you know, some people really like to work up a real... So that exists also in a more purified sense. There is even anger in the spiritual world in an appropriate place. So, because there's joy, and there's very strange pleasures in the world, like even especially, you know, when you get to the crux of our philosophy, the so-called pleasure of separation from, like, you know, being separated from someone you love, there's a pain there that is somewhat, you know, there's some kind of bliss, bittersweet. So every single, basically every single feeling you've ever experienced, there is an ultimatum of that experience, and it's constantly revolving and changing and churning. And then there's also a very large sense of stability. Like, I remember we were doing rasa theory, and there's stayi bhava. Stayi means, like, stable. It's probably derived from similar, you know, lingual roots. Stayi. So there's bhava means, like, existence or mood. So there's something very permanent. You feel very, you know, you're very grounded, so to speak. You know when you feel like you really found your place in life? You get to feel that. So you feel like, you know, that's the thing. You have all these feelings. And then there's also where you feel displaced, you know, especially in terms of the romantic rasas that are explained. You know, but it's perfect displacement, if you could describe it. Yeah, ultimately, when you try to describe it, you realize it's very undescribable. So I don't know if I helped at all. But yeah, whatever joys you ever experience, you can almost just hold on to those and realize that there's something even better than that. And sometimes joys in this world are very limited. So it's good to understand that there is ultimately something worth kind of progressing for. Oh, and another point, just one quick point. Like, we were studying in Jiva Goswami, I think one of our essay questions was about explaining the miseries of the world, and it's like the polar opposite of, you know, so eternality, knowledge, and bliss are three major symptoms of the spiritual world. So material world, you experience temporality, you experience misery, and you experience ignorance. Sound familiar? So just imagine a world excluding those things. That's spiritual. Exactly. That's how like caught in this box we are. Anything else to discuss? Turn it though. The point is not to be depressed, because there's something blissful always, and that blissful thing is you. That's the point. It's like we haven't even tapped into who we are, because we're actually happy. That sounds kind of creepy, but yeah, we're actually happy people that are covered by misery. And the point is to get rid of the covering, because we keep thinking that we're miserable. But that's just because we're associating with this material world. When you associate with yourself, which is also spiritual, associate with Krishna and other people in the spiritual sense, then you derive happiness. It's good to know it's not too far away. It's just kind of difficult to access at the moment. Anything else? Remy? How to combine, you mean like a sense of miserable humility?
Yeah.
Well, the main thing is to only, you should only, I, this is probably my own personal opinion. A lot of people try to express humility when they don't have it, and don't mix it with low self-esteem. This is something Bhakti Tirtha Swami very much emphasized. People think humility is thinking yourself like, you're disgusting, you're horrible, can't even stand the sight of you. But it's not so much the point. The point is, someone who's humble, they don't mind their insignificance. Because, I mean, they don't mind comparing themselves, excuse me, as something insignificant to something so magnificent. You see these people, they're comparing themselves to unlimited and they're feeling so little. And really, as a soul, we are so little compared to the ultimate reality. But it's not to get depressed about. If you're getting depressed, like if your humility should make you, should give you energy. If it's not giving you energy to progress spiritually, then it's probably low self-esteem. Then there's no point. It's better just to be happy. I mean, if there's no reason to be sad and no reason to be happy, may as well be happy, right? So until, I think that to let that become, it comes naturally. Like Prabhupada says, you chant Hare Krishna, these things come naturally. Humility comes naturally. I've got a lot of natural reasons to become humble, but, and everyone has a low self-esteem issue, I think, especially in this world, because it's such an unloving world at the moment. But I try to see it as my spiritual objective to keep a high self-esteem. Because if you have a high self-esteem, you benefit others. If you have a low self-esteem, you upset other people. And so therefore, you're actually doing violence to other people. If you have a genuine reason to have a low self-esteem, that's okay. You don't beat yourself up again. No more about it. But you genuinely should have good spirits. Bhaktivinoda Thakur was humble, but he didn't have bad spirits. He didn't do it to... Like when you read Bhaktivinoda Thakur, does it make you feel like doing nothing and kind of... Does it make you become depressed and closed off from society? No, it churns you to feel like I need to be more genuine in my spiritual life. So I think that's one thing you could look at. Is it helping you in your spiritual life? If it's not, then it's probably low self-esteem and you just need to smile more and have another burpee. Is that okay, Remy? Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah, I mean, Prabhupada says this body, or I mean, I suppose this existence, is an embarrassment to the soul. So, like, generally you can feel embarrassed for your material condition, but that means all as well. Like, you know, you see, like, even someone who's... You have to understand that great material opulences, being a king, is still worthless because it's material. So, although you can, like, now, you know, your position materially is worthless, but even if you progress materially, it's still worthless. It's still worthless. Like, I mean, Prabhupada says, you know, you, when you die, you take nothing. I mean, it's... Yeah. Family, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, what's the point of thinking with these things? That's the thing, we get so caught up, like, really trying to make people really love our personality and our style. It's okay not to be negligent of material things, you know, especially if you want to preach or something, you have to meet people. But it's not worth being caught up in. I mean, like, look what... The thing is, we're so busy thinking about material things, but if you stop for a moment and you look... You know, we're sitting here in a temple learning about spiritual absolute truth, and to have that opportunity means that for so many lifetimes we've been trying to get to this point. So actually, our wealth is outstanding, spiritual wealth, really. You might, like, look at yourself in the mirror every day and go, you know, my rounds are terrible, I'm offensive to devotees, but have a good look as well and realize I actually have the spiritual intelligence to even think about these things. Most people don't even know that there's such a thing as a devotee or the Bhagavad Gita. I mean, you say this, the Bhagavad, you know, people can't even pronounce the name of this text. But you have the chance to be associating with this every single moment of your life. That's an amazing wealth. And actually, if you just realize how lucky, if we realize how lucky we are alone, I sometimes say that's probably enough to get us back to Godhead, because that's like, I mean, that's honestly a spiritual realization. And that's really what a lot of the time we're just trying to appreciate what we have already. And so rather than just picking on ourselves all the time for how limited we are and realizing we're all limited in a bodily concept, we may as well look at what we actually have, which is spiritual and unlimited, and feel good about it. Knowing that when I die, I'm going to be better off than when I started this life. And that by Lord Chaitanya's mercy and Lord Nityananda's mercy, my next life, I'll also most likely have the association of Krishna and devotees. If I don't make it now back to a spiritual realm, I still have a perfectly legitimate chance to do it again. And that's very comforting. A person in the mode of goodness, he's happy because he knows that when he dies, he takes a better birth. That's what gives him his happiness. He's not worried in life because he has that knowledge that I'll be able to advance from here. So we should take some comfort in that. And humility should come naturally. You still can feel insignificant. You know, I don't deserve this mercy. We don't deserve this mercy. But we still got this mercy. So there's something to feel humble about, and then there's something to feel really happy about. It's a free ride. Grab it while you still can. I have to stop, I think. Bhajan time. Gunaraj Shriman Bhagavad Gita Ki.